Good morning, this is Focus 580. My name is Jack Brighton, filling in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen today. A few people listening might know that besides occasionally hosting this show, I also sometimes play guitar, which I guess is why the producers wanted me to host this morning. Well, I can also ride a bicycle, but that doesn't quite make me Lance Armstrong. So, if I know how to tune the instrument and play a few chords, it really doesn't qualify me to ask intelligent questions of a guitarist like Alex DeGrassi, our guest during this hour of Focus 580. However, a lack of intelligent questions has never actually stopped me from hosting the show. So, regardless of how that all works out, during this hour we'll talk with Alex DeGrassi about his music and his career, and we'll play a good bit of his music as well, which you hear in the background. Our visit here with Alex DeGrassi coincides with a little event at the Krannert Center for Performing Arts called the Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival. It's actually a small series of events that started last week and runs through this weekend. Okay, it's not exactly a small series, but in fact a huge concert series phenomenon. One of the most amazing collections of guitar talent and artistry ever held anywhere, from classical to jazz, folk, world, rock, and just about every other musical genre you can imagine. This is in fact the second Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival presented by the Krannert Center, with artistic advisor David Spellman, founder of the New York Guitar Festival. I guess Krannert director Mike Ross figures if New York can do it, so can we here at the University of Illinois. Anyway, if you are attending the Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival, I will see you there. And if you want to know more about it and see if any tickets are still actually available, you can call Krannert at 217-333-6280 or go on the web to walltowallguitar.com. Our guest during this hour, Focus 580, Alex DeGrassi, will perform at 5 p.m. this Saturday in Krannert's Tryon Festival Theater in an event called Wood, Steel, and Beyond, along with Khaki King and Tony McManus. Other performers that evening include John McLaughlin, Jorma Kekkonen, and Buddy Guy. If you haven't got them yet, good luck with those tickets. But at least you don't need one this morning for our conversation with Alex DeGrassi, and if you'd like to join the conversation, all you have to do is pick up the telephone. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and we have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us around the Midwest, or anywhere in the U.S. if you're listening online. That number, 800-222-9455. A little bit more about our guest. Alex DeGrassi is one of the world's greatest fingerstyle steel string guitarists. He uses a combination of techniques that make his solo performances sound like, well, certainly not a solo guitarist. While critics and listeners have remarked on his amazing technique, his playing would probably best be defined by the depth of its musicality. Alex DeGrassi's discography includes a number of acclaimed recordings on Windham Hill, RCA Novus, and Tropo Records, among others. He has toured just about everywhere, performing in Europe, Japan, and throughout North America, including Carnegie Hall, Interlaken, the Montreux Jazz Festival, and the Belfast International Festival. He recorded his first album in 1978 for the then-brand-new startup label Windham Hill, and that album, Turning Back, is now cited by Acoustic Guitar Magazine as one of the top 10 essential fingerstyle guitar recordings of all time. His 10th recording, The Water Garden, was nominated for both a Grammy and an Indie Award. His compositions and performances reveal a wide range of musical influences and interests, from classical, jazz, blues, folk music, and well beyond. We'll play some of that music and talk with him about that during this hour. Alex DeGrassi joins us now on the air by telephone. Good morning.
Jack?
Yes, hello, Alex.
You're there. All right, great.
Can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, looking forward to seeing you Saturday at Krannert, too.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Just to kind of start, I read that you are a highly trained economic geographer, but but largely self-taught on the guitar. Can you talk about how you got into the guitar and how you found the path to the way you play now?
Well, I played trumpet when I was a kid in school bands and orchestras. Come from somewhat of a musical family. My grandfather was a violinist with the San Francisco Symphony, and my father was trained as a classical pianist. And my mother was just a big fan of jazz. And so I played trumpet when I was a little kid. One day my mother brought home a guitar for my older brother, who had a good singing voice, and thought this would be a nice thing for Tony to learn how to play to accompany himself. Somehow within about 5 days, it was clear that it was my guitar. I gave my trumpet away, stopped reading music for a while, and just started listening to records and learning all kinds of folk and blues music. That's how I got started.
Mm-hmm. Your approach, the fingerstyle technique and so forth, it really is truly astonishing. You mentioned influences like John Renborn, Leo Kottke, John Fahey, Ralph Tanner. I also hear a kinship with Michael Hedges in there as well.
Right.
This is, to me, like amazing way to play. I just can't even fathom how you come up with that particular method of playing. Can you talk about, especially the right hand, how important that is in the style that you play?
Right. Well, I continued to learn a lot of fingerstyle guitar. Paul Simon was big influence and so forth. But when I got older, I started becoming interested in jazz and classical guitar. So even though I am, in a sense, largely self-taught, I did have an opportunity to learn from a few really good teachers. I studied jazz guitar with a guy named Bill Thrasher when I went off to university, who was a partner of Joe Pass and authored a lot of those books. I studied a little bit of music at the University of California in Berkeley, and I also studied privately off and on. But I never really studied guitar per se, so it's kind of interesting. I have a lot of different musical influences. The actual techniques that I use are really, I would say, a hybrid of folk guitar, classical guitar, and whatever else I can find to listen to and be influenced by. So I think what's happened is the steel string guitar has traditionally been a folk instrument, and what we've seen over the last maybe 30, 40 years with going back to players, even further going back with folk and blues players like Mississippi John Hurt and a lot of the country Delta blues players right on up through Leo Kottke, John Fahey, and people today like Tommy Emmanuel and Kaki King, who's going to be on this bill, as well as just a host of amazing fingerstyle guitar players, is it's kind of grown up, and people have brought their different cultural influence, whether it's Celtic music or North African music or Brazilian music, into the fold, and suddenly you have this world of steel string guitar where you just find all kinds of musical influences, and I think that's kind of describes my path as well. So the right hand technique is very important because I guess for me, I'm sort of known for playing, as you might have heard in that introductory piece, a lot of fast arpeggios and sort of pulling notes out of it to get sort of an orchestrated sound.
Right. Yeah, you get a lot of different things going on that sort of layer on top of each other.
Yeah.
It seems like. I could never understand how to get the strength and articulation fingerstyle with the right hand, and when I listen to your playing, it just sounds so effortless. I mean, how do you do that? Is it a natural thing that you fell into doing? I mean, how much effort did it take to develop that kind of articulation?
Well, I mean, it's what I've been doing for the last 30 years professionally, and it's what I've been doing for longer than that as a player.
Yeah.
It's sort of sometimes hard for me to kind of understand how I got from A to B. But again, I think the right hand technique, people say, oh, that's a Degrassi thing when they hear one of these real fast arpeggios. And that always just came natural to me. I was one of these players that really developed the right hand much more strongly before I developed the left hand. Mm-hmm. And for folks out there who are not guitar players, what we're talking about is what really the hand that picks the strings versus the hand that frets the strings and plays the chords and all that kind of stuff. Of course, the techniques have changed so much. When you see somebody, if you had a chance to see Michael Hedges while he was alive, or see somebody like Preston Reed or Kaki King play using a two-hand tapping approach, you realize that the techniques keep evolving, so the notion of a picking hand and a fretting hand is much less clear than it used to be. I tend to use more of a clear definition between the two, but I also use some of the extended techniques. And so when I talk about the right hand, I'm talking a lot about just the hand that picks the notes. And I think one of the things that I've done is been able to figure out how to accent the notes in such a way that I create sort of a three-dimensional sound, is how I explain it when I'm doing workshops and so forth, which is to say that if you have a big spray of notes like you heard in that introduction, mm-hmm. you have to be able to have the fingers have to be able to figure out very quickly whether it's playing that note hard or soft, and the fingers of the left hand need to be able to know whether to put a little vibrato on there or change the intonation or something. And all those things put together give it an effect like there's a lot more going on than it appears when you watch somebody playing.
Well, let's hear some more of your recordings. This is next track is a cut called The Mirror off of 1991 disc Deep at Night. Does that sound like a decent thing to play at this point?
Sure.
Okay. They're all great, so it's hard to really pick. So let's hear a little bit of this, and actually it's about 2 minutes long, so we might as well hear the whole thing, and we'll talk some more with Alex DeGrassi. Ooh, nice chord to end on.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't actually played that in a long time or even heard that in a long time, so that's kind of fun for me.
All right. Well, it's a terrific track. I mean, like I say, they're all just simply amazing. I'm curious about improvisation and the way that you might play that if you were or whatever you're going to play. A lot of these recordings, you know, I can't tell how much they're fully composed and how much you sort of leave yourself room to play around with them when you play them live. I'm curious about that.
Right. Well, the whole process of writing or arranging these solo pieces for me is sort of improvisational in that I do eventually write them out in notation, but I don't kind of work from the paper to the guitar. I tend to work from the guitar towards the paper. So the process is sort of this getting for me, I often start with a rhythmic idea or what I would call a texture, you know, something that just it sort of has a groove or it has a certain kind of textural feel, like that opening piece. The prelude has a certain kind of watery feel to it. This one has kind of a dramatic feel to me. I actually wrote the piece for The Mirror for a theater production in San Francisco, which is a little bit unusual. I haven't done a lot of that, but when I play it, pieces like that, when I'm writing it, I sort of have a lot of different variations. And then when I start to perform it or record it, I usually settle on one way. But then once it's recorded, I might start working on variations. And some pieces have more room for improvisation than others. But there's not a tremendous amount of improvisation when I play live in these solo pieces. But there is some. So I try not to get it too set in stone.
Let me just reintroduce our guest this morning during this hour, Focus 580, Alex DeGrassi, the amazing fingerstyle steel string guitarist. He is performing this Saturday at the Krannert Center, part of the Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival, and his performance begins at 5 p.m. at the Tryon Festival Theater, and you should definitely see if tickets are still available if you like music. And we have him here for the next half an hour or so, and if you have questions, you are welcome to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. One of the aspects of guitar playing that always strikes me as I hear different players is how differently each person approaches the guitar in terms of attitude and technique. And I'm not sure that's as true for every instrument or even, you know, a lot of other instruments. Maybe the guitar is just somehow more personal and lends itself to greater variation. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, the guitar is, especially the acoustic guitar, even more so than the electric guitar in some ways, is not an orchestral or a big band instrument. So there's less literature for, you know, there's less tradition of playing it in big groups. I mean, that, having said that, of course, there are groups like bluegrass, folk groups, and so forth that utilize it. And occasionally, you know, you'll see a pop singer or a rock and roll player pick up an acoustic guitar, but it's usually not necessarily the core musical instrument. And so that means that a lot of people are playing solo guitar when they pick up an acoustic guitar, and that's even true to a large extent with classical guitar. You do have classical guitarists playing with orchestras and so forth, but not nearly to the extent that you would a violinist or a pianist or something. So you end up with a lot more music solo, and I think that means that there's a lot more people working in isolation, which, you know, I suppose has its good and its bad sides. Sometimes when I do workshops, I know guitar players, some professional and some amateurs, and just say, boy, it's so great to be in a room full of people playing acoustic guitar. I spend so much of my life playing myself. And I think that might have something to do with it. The other thing I think is it's just an incredibly popular instrument, on the other hand. It's played in so many different countries around the world, and it's just such a versatile instrument. You can tune it any way you want. I use a lot of alternate tunings, and I know a lot of the solo guitar players that are at the festival also do that. So there's that avenue. It really is a very versatile instrument.
Yeah. We have a call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. Someone in Farina, Illinois, on line number 4. Good morning.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'm not real familiar with your music, but I do like the style. It sounds like it's got a little more of a jazz flavor. I'm a huge fan of Jorma Kalkinen and his Hot Tuna work, and I've seen him live a few times. He plays tunes by a musician named Reverend Gary Davis, and then there's one other. I'd like you to comment on what you know about him and how you, if you like Jorma's styling. Also, could you kind of give a definition of the Piedmont style versus the Mississippi Delta style? I imagine you would know. And thanks a lot.
Wow. Well, I certainly know who the Reverend Gary Davis was, and he was quite an influential player for fingerstyle blues players. And there's a fellow named Woody Mann who lives in New York who is out doing a lot of that kind of stuff today. And he actually studied with the Reverend Gary Davis, I believe, when he was young. And I know that there's a whole generation of blues and kind of maybe folk and blues, maybe even rock player, you know, pop players who are influenced by that whole Delta blues thing. You know, I learned a little. I remember listening to Reverend Gary Davis records when I was a young teenager, and also people like Mississippi John Hurt and Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, Lightning Hopkins, Tampa Red, you know, the list goes on and on. It's a really strong tradition, and I certainly learned some of that. I played a little bit of blues harp as well when I was a teenager, and somehow I just kind of moved on in a little different direction ultimately, but certainly I'd have to say that whole Delta country blues tradition is part of what I know as a fingerstyle player, and it's sort of at the root of a lot of what a lot of fingerstyle players play. As far as you know, I'm a fan of Yorma's. I remember him from the Jefferson Airplane days, and he had that. He had a couple solo guitar pieces on some of those records. Just my brain is trying to work faster to recall the one that was so famous that a lot of us learned that he played.
I think it was Embryonic Journey.
Embryonic Journey, yeah. And you know, that was a piece that I learned. I think a lot of fingerstyle players are still learning that today. It's sort of a classic. You know, that one, a couple of Leo Kottke pieces, and John Fahey's in Christ There Is No East or West. There's a few of those that just, you know, if you go around and you hang out with acoustic guitar players, those pieces will inevitably come up. As far as differentiating between the Piedmont style and the Delta style, you might be asking the wrong person. I've never been particularly good at, you know, I know less about that than I should, perhaps. I do know the difference between Travis picking and a lot of the blues styles, and the Travis picking thing is something that you would find in the music of someone like Chet Atkins and of course, Merle Travis, for whom it's named after. The Piedmont style, I kind of have some idea, but I'm kind of, I'd probably make a mess of it trying to explain a difference.
It's all right. Well, I appreciate that. And I also appreciate Henry Frayne, our director, reminding me of the name of Embryonic Journey, that track off the Jefferson Airplane disc. And credit where credit is due, I should mention that Henry is actually the most amazing guitar player here at WILL. There's several of us, actually.
Great.
But Henry has this group called Lanterna, and I just want to give a shout-out to him because he's doing some amazing things on, actually, the world scene. So, anyway, thanks, Henry. By the way, we would welcome other callers. If you would like to join us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, again, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. I want to ask you about alternate tunings. You use different tunings, I gather, a number of different tunings?
I do. You know, when I first learned how to play guitar, I learned in standard tuning like a lot of folks and learned a lot of folk and blues and jazz chords and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, I think through listening to John Fahey and then Leo Kottke, I discovered that these guys were using different kinds of open or alternate tunings. And so I started doing that as well. You know, some of those tunings come out of the bluegrass scene and the whole country music scene. And when I say country, I mean a more going back years. Dobros, for example, banjos often use C or G tunings or D tunings. Slide guitar blues players would often use open tunings like D or G. So there is a tradition of that. I think when I started playing, I started trying out a couple of those and then started experimenting with making up some tunings of my own, and some of them got pretty obscure, and then, you know, next thing I knew, all kinds of people were doing that. People like Michael Hedges used some very unusual tunings. And the principle there is that by retuning the guitar, you can get different chord voicings, different ways of playing harmonies. You can get different relationships between the strings, such that it makes it easier to play certain things. I mean, if you're going along playing in a standard tune, you say, you know, gee, if I could only reach up there and grab that melody note, and then you say, well, if I tuned that string down a whole step, I probably could. And once you start doing that, it's sort of a never-ending process of experimenting with different tunings. One of the other things I should say about the open tunings is that they tend to reinforce some of the overtones in the guitar so that you can create a certain resonance with the guitar. It actually can sometimes make the guitar sound louder or bring out certain overtones in the guitar, and also by tuning it lower or higher, you can change the feel of the guitar. So, for example, if you tune a note down very low, one of the bass strings, suddenly it becomes a lot easier to bend that note or play with the pitch or do slides or glissandos or things that give it a certain kind of juicy character that you wouldn't get by playing in a standard tuning.
You know, I also hear you sort of using open strings, I think, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
You know, to play off of with fretted strings, that different tunings give you different options.
Right. And, you know, you get that contrast between the open string and the fretted string, which is a real powerful tool because, especially when you're playing solo, you're in a sense being kind of an orchestrator, and you say, I want those notes to have a certain kind of dry, crisp, rhythmic sound, and I want those notes to have a kind of an articulate sound that's more bent and kind of that can control it, start and stop the string, and so forth. So you get those kinds of contrasts going, and you really can do a lot with that.
We have another call to talk with. Let's do that. Someone in Bloomington, Illinois, next. Line number one. Good morning.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
What you're just talking about kind of answered some of my questions, but it's wonderful. It's kind of hard for me as trying to do alternate tuning and open tuning to do Tom Rush songs like No Regrets and Rockport Sunday and that. Even with a chromatic tuner, I have a difficult time. Can you give any hints and I'll get off? Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Thanks.
Jack, I had a little difficulty hearing that just through the phone. Maybe you could just summarize that question again?
I think what he was asking is when trying out alternate tunings, just getting them in the correct pitch is difficult using like a chromatic tuner or whatever, and then wondered if you had any suggestions about how to approach that problem.
Right. One of the things that happens when you change the tuning, I mean, let's assume you start in a standard tuning with a guitar and using a tuner and you can play up and down the fingerboard and everything sounds pretty in tune. When you change, let's say you lower the bass string down to D or C or go to dad-gad tuning, which is a very popular tuning, you might notice that when you tune using harmonics or the tuner, that something doesn't quite add up. And what happens is the guitar, like the piano, like most Western instruments today, is a tempered instrument, meaning the tuning has been cheated slightly to make it possible to modulate and play in all keys and have that same kind of relationship. Historically, like before Bach's time, there were the keyboard instruments were not tempered, and therefore they couldn't really modulate, because when they modulated, say, from the key of A to the key of E, suddenly it sounded kind of out of tune. And, you know, this can get pretty complex, this whole study, but this is all by way of saying when you go to an alternate tuning, you are playing with the temperament a little bit. And, for example, especially the B string, the second string on a guitar, is sort of famous for being a problem. And so what you have to do sometimes is slightly cheat it. So the tuner might say, well, that note's just a little bit flat, but when I go play on the string is being pulled a little bit sharp. So if you're playing in the first position or the fifth position on the guitar, you kind of experiment a little bit and see where the best tuning is, and you may have to slightly flatten one of the strings, especially when you have tunings where the strings are very close together, like dad-gad, the relationship between the second and third string, which is just a whole tone between the G and the A. Sometimes when you tune those strings perfectly with a tuner, start playing that second string sounds sharp, and so you compensate that for that a little bit by flatting it. Oftentimes the low string, if you tune it way down, sometimes that can sound a little bit sharp when you fret it higher up the fingerboard, so you might flat that a little bit. But you have to play with it a little bit. And some people actually who, like there's a fellow, Pierre-Vian Suzanne, who's famous French guitarist for playing in dad-gad exclusively. It's like standard tuning. He might actually have the saddle of his guitar intonated in such a way that it's set up to play in dad-gad. And I have talked to people who, and I've done this with one of my guitars, I've had the saddle intonated such that it's in tune when I'm in a particular tuning that I use a lot, which is C, G, D, G, A, D. And when I tune it up to standard tuning, which I don't really do with that particular guitar, sometimes it's a little testy, the tuning on it. But it works well in that open tuning.
Well, that's great. I hope that helps the caller. Other callers are welcome. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Alex DeGrassi, fingerstyle guitarist extraordinaire, performing this Saturday, 5 p.m. at the Krannert Tryon Festival Theater as part of the Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival. Again, this is the second of the Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival series at Krannert. I think every 2 years is the plan, so this is take two, and then next time it'll be three of something. And so anyway, we'll talk with Alex in the remaining part of this hour, and also Bob Brosman on Friday will be on the show, and hopefully we'll get some other interviews on tape as part of this amazing experience. So many great players visiting town. So anyway, with that, let's carry on. I wanted to play some more music, Alex, and there's in particular the from the disc Now and Then, which I really love. It's a collection of really folk music songs that you've interpreted in your way, and you know, sort of reinterpreting those traditions for, you know, the style and the time now, or your particular approach. So I thought we'd play a little bit of St. James Infirmary, if that's all right with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, great. Let's hear a little bit of that. I think it's probably too long to play the whole track. Apologies for that, but let's get a little bit of it at least.
Sure.
Okay, so that's St. James Infirmary off of the disc Now and Then, which is on 33rd Street Records. And that came out, was that 2003?
2003, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I also found it on iTunes, so you can find actually several discs there.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, it's a great song. And, you know, what I tried to do with that song and all the pieces on that album is to take a lot of well-known folk songs, and when I say folk songs, I mean ones that are public domain, and they're either folk songs or spirituals, or there's some cowboy songs on there,
yeah.
And arrange them in a more contemporary way, which means not only arranging the melody as we know it, but in some cases writing additional material, and also taking a lot of liberties with the harmonies, and also in some cases changing the rhythm completely. Like I did a version of "O Susanna" on there that we turned into a samba, and I was kind of trying to explore the connections. In some cases, sort of in a world music way like that, where I started. You know, I was a big fan of Brazilian music, and I was also listening to some old Ralph Stanley, the Stanley Brothers music, and I started thinking, you know, the banjo rhythms and the Brazilian samba rhythms, they're not that different. Mm. They have something in common, and I was trying to bridge that gap a little bit. So there's a lot of that going on in this record.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, you know, Banning Air, he writes about African music a lot, and he basically kind of documents the origin of the banjo in Africa.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting.
Right, yeah, yeah. Well, there's a lot of, I mean, you know, obviously there's all kinds of African music,
yeah,
roots in our folk culture here in the United States. And so it's just interesting. I did another piece on the album. It's called Lay This Body Down. It's an old spiritual. It probably dates back to the Civil War era. And in my arrangement, I thought, you know, this is spiritual kind of, in some ways, fed into the blues, and blues fed into the jazz. So I tried to arrange it with some kind of a shuffle, blues shuffle rhythm, and bring some jazz chords in it. And then I have a section of the piece where I go back and play, where I do this muting or damping on the strings and play a very syncopated pattern, which sounds, to my ears, a little bit African. And so that, again, you know, it's trying to tie these threads through time and across, look a little deeper into some of the cultural connections.
I wish we had time to play a whole bunch more. I do want to get to at least a couple more tracks, though, because they're so different, and different kinds of music that you interpret. There's one in particular. I personally love the song Round Midnight.
And oh, yeah.
Just about, you know, anyone's version of it, but this is really a different version. This is from a disc called Bolivian Blues Bar.
Right.
And yeah, it has a bunch of great, you know, jazz standards on it.
Yeah, it was my first attempt to record jazz standards. I you know, I grew up and I studied jazz a little bit, and I'd heard a lot when I was a kid, but I never really thought of myself as a jazz musician. And then after many years of doing the solo guitar thing, I thought maybe I'll take a stab at doing some of my favorite pieces. And I kind of looked at them not so much as jazz, but as pieces that I really love. And I'm a huge Thelonious Monk fan, and of course that's a really great song, Round Midnight.
Well, let's hear a little bit. That's just amazing. I love that. Are you in standard tuning there?
I am in standard tuning. Yeah, it's pretty much everything on that recording is standard tuning. I think because they're jazz standards, I have arranged a couple popular jazz pieces in unusual tunings, like I did a Jimi Hendrix piece in a really unusual tuning. But my frame of reference for those pieces was more standard tuning, so. That's what they are.
Yeah, that's great. We're going to run out of time in just, you know, about 8 or 10 minutes here, and there's so much more I want to talk about and more tracks I want to play. One of the things I wanted to ask you to talk about is your group, Demania, with Michael Manring, a bass player, and a percussionist, Chris Garcia.
Right.
And you have an album out last year from I guess, your own label, Tropo Records. This is a trio. It's quite a different, you know, sort of musical lineup than certainly solo guitar, but, you know, just incredibly beautiful.
Thanks. Well, yeah, Demania is an acronym for Degrassi, Manring, Michael Manring, and Chris Garcia. So Michael and I have known each other a little bit for a long, long time. We would run across each other at different festivals and events, and we'd always play a couple tunes together. So a few years back, I said, "Hey, Michael, let's, it would be fun if we had a trio." And he had just worked with Chris Garcia in Los Angeles. Chris plays with Frank Zappa's old band, the Grandmothers Reinvented, as well as playing jazz and a lot of world music, and he even plays with the On Trio, a classical trio. So he's quite a versatile player. He plays tabla. He's trained tabla player, and with us he plays tabla, sits on the floor, and also plays a variety of other hand percussion and as well as cymbals and stuff. So it's kind of a world jazz hybrid setup that he has. And so we just made our first record last year. We are out touring a little bit this fall, and you know, it's, we all write for the group. It's arrangements, mostly our own music right now, but we're doing some pieces, folk songs, some jazz standards, and we're really just trying to have a real broad base of music. So there are arranged heads, and then we do a lot of improvisation.
Yeah, and Michael Magring, of course, regarded by all the bass players I know as, you know, sort of a guitar hero, you know, on the bass, certainly. Amazing player.
Yeah, he's an amazing solo player. He does some incredible stuff with the electric fretless, and of course, he toured with Michael Hedges for many years, and you know, a lot of the techniques that Michael was using, I think they shared a lot of stuff, and so you see Michael doing some pretty outrageous stuff when he plays.
Yeah.
And
Well, I want to give people a taste of this, at least. This is a track called McCoy off of Demania. Demania or Demania?
Demania. When we went to Latin America, it was Demania.
Right, Demania. Anyway, this is a, we'll play a little, this is a 7-minute track, so we won't go that long with it, but here it is.
Yeah.
So that's Demania,
yeah,
and a track called McCoy. And again, the guest this morning, Alex DeGracia, who is performing this Saturday at Cranert, part of the Wall to Wall Guitar Festival. Pretty cool disc.
Yeah, that's fun. That's a piece I wrote called McCoy, inspired by McCoy Tyner, the famous jazz pianist.
Right. So talk about playing solo versus working with an ensemble. I mean, you've obviously, most of your recordings are solo, but you've done a lot of ensemble work.
I have. I really like working with other musicians. I have to work a little harder because, you know, most people, I always have this joke with other musicians. They say, "Oh, man, it must be so intense playing solo, so nerve-wracking. I don't know how you do that." And I say, "Well, I don't have to pay attention to what anybody else is doing." So, you know, there's a flip side of that. When I play with other musicians, I really have to work a little bit harder to focus on what's going on with the group dynamic and where we are in the music. And since playing solo or with the group, there's sometimes improvisation involved. I have to, you know, realize that even though there's improvisation involved, that there are all these cues that we have to really be tight with. And I've done another kind of a collaboration recently, which was a lot of fun. I had the good fortune to get commissioned to write a piece along with a violinist named Jeremy Cohen for a steel string guitar, string quartet, and string orchestra, which we premiered last spring in San Francisco. And that was a whole other level of collaboration for me. And that was very intense, but I've had a chance to do it a few times now, and I'm starting to get more relaxed with being on stage with 27 string players.
Well, speaking of 27 strings, I also wanted to ask you about the instrument called the Carlson Sympitar.
Right.
Which is a multi-string, that's a layer of sympathetic strings.
Right. I have Fred Carlson just is a mad genius guitar builder sculptor who lives in Santa Cruz, California. He's from Vermont originally. And he built a guitar that's a six-string guitar, but it has 12 sympathetic strings that run under the top, through the neck, under the fingerboard, and emerge on the headstock. And you can tune them in a mode, and then they buzz along with you, much like a sitar or some East Indian instrument. And it's kind of a specialty instrument for me, but now that I'm playing with this Domania trio, especially with Chris playing tabla and the texture of Michael's fretless bass, it really works quite well, so I play it quite a bit in the trio.
Do you also tune the sympathetic strings based on the tuning of the main strings?
Yeah, I mean, I keep experimenting with it. There's 12 of them, so you could tune it chromatically, but I found that I have more success by doubling up on some of them. And if we're working in a mode, like more of a folk thing, a song, I can tune it to a scale. And then if we have something that's more chromatic, I might choose a couple of the chromatic notes as well, or just pick the notes that I want to emphasize with the buzz out of the chromatic scale. So that it's constantly I'm constantly experimenting with that.
Mm-hmm. We just have about 4 minutes left. I'm sorry to say we're not going to be able to play a whole lot more music. We do have another caller waiting, though, so let's include them before we're totally out of time. Listener on line number one. Good morning.
Sorry to ask it, but if you were stranded on a desert island, what albums would you want?
If I was on a desert island, what album would I want?
Yeah.
Well, I got to say probably one of my favorite albums of all time is by a pianist and guitar player named Egberto Gismonti, and it's called Sanfona, S-A-N-F-O-N-A. He's a great guitar player. Pardon me?
Go ahead. I think our caller hung up. So
oh, yeah. Yeah. That would probably be the key one. I don't know. There's so many other good ones, though. I don't know. If I just had one, that's what I'd have.
Okay. Well, let's hope that doesn't happen, though, really, because,
yeah,
you know, so much great music you want to hear. We have a couple minutes left. I'm tempted to ask you a philosophical question I'm always curious about, you know, with musicians. You know, what is it that drives you to the level of musicianship you've achieved on the guitar? Is it something you hear inside that you need or want to express? Is it a calling? Is it a matter of ego? Or does it have to do with more than your individual self, the need to express, to play music?
Well, when I was younger, I mean, I kind of went through, when I was a kid, I went through a period where I wrote a few short stories and I wanted to be a writer and a storyteller. You know, I don't know if they were any good, but I was just a kid. But when I got into playing guitar, I wrote a lot of songs, and I sang for a while up until about the time I was 20, 21, decided I wasn't such a great singer, and that my heart, for some reason, wasn't totally in writing songs with lyrics. But I always wanted to tell stories, if you will, in some way, and I think that playing guitar, or any kind of music for that matter, there's a level of abstraction in which you can be sort of a storyteller or give voice to your inner, your sense of poetry, I guess. And yet, there's a certain freedom there, because if I say, well, this piece is, in my mind, is has a kind of watery feel, or this one has a very urban feel, or this one reminds me of the time I went to Greece or something like that, then I can work with that as kind of an image in my head. But the listener is really free on the other end to get whatever they want out of it. But I think the important thing is if you have something that you're really invested, that music is invested in some impression or something like that, the listener will get that. And I think that's part of what drives me, is because I want to really complete that picture and make it as strong as I possibly can. And sometimes that requires a lot of getting into the fine details, as well as being able to kind of grasp the big picture.
Well, we're going to have to stop, unfortunately. I want to leave just a little bit of time to play one more track as we conclude this hour of Focus 580. Our guest, Alex DeGrassi, again, and his last name is DeGrassi, and you can look up his website, by the way, www.degrassi.com. You can also find him on iTunes, and you can find him at Krannert this coming Saturday, 5 p.m., as part of the Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival. Alex, I want to thank you, and I want to play the zipper off your disc, The Water Garden, which we started with.
Yeah.
And so we'll say see you Saturday, and we'll leave listeners with this. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jack. It's been a pleasure.